Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
It's 2:40. In sports, the men's NCAA basketball tournament is back in action this evening with four games. In the East Regional, in Boston, Pittsburgh goes against Xavier, while Duke meets Villanova. In the West Regional, in Glendale, Arizona, game one has Connecticut playing Purdue, while number two features Memphis and Missouri. The semifinals are set for the men's NIT. Notre Dame advanced with a win over Kentucky last night, while San Diego State beat St. Mary's of California. In the semis, Notre Dame will play Penn State, while San Diego State will play Baylor at Madison Square Garden. In women's college basketball action tonight, Illinois State takes on Marquette in the third round of the WNIT tournament. Marquette is the defending WNIT champion. The teams have only faced each other twice before, with each winning one game. Miami has won all three meetings against the Chicago Bulls this season, going into tonight's matchup at the United Center. The last time the Heat swept a regular season series against Chicago was in 2003-2004. The games this season haven't been one-sided, with Miami winning the last two by a combined 5 points. And the St. Louis Blues are back in action tonight at the Scott Trade Center, where they will play the Vancouver Canucks. St. Louis improved to 9-4-1 since February 24th, with Tuesday's 2-0 win over Los Angeles. The Blues are battling for a Western Conference playoff spot. That's sports.
Are these people in your carpool?
This is David Inge.
I'm Celeste Quinn.
I'm Scott Simon.
I'm Carl Castle from NPR News. Beep, beep, beep,
beep, yeah. Whether you're coming or going, you depend on us to keep you company. We depend on you for financial support to make that possible. Give to our member match fund today, and we'll use your dollars on April 15th to challenge others to help make great programs possible on WILL. Go to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
It's 2:42. It's not uncommon to hear claims of media bias, but new research suggests those claims are full of hot air. Illinois Public Radio's Rich Egger reports.
Tanya Atkins-Covert and Philo Wasburn studied how four social issues were covered between 1975 and 2000. Those issues are crime, the environment, gender, and poverty. Atkins-Covert says the publications they studied are Time, Newsweek, National Review, and The Progressive.
We did find that Time and Newsweek were very centrist in their coverage. And there was one exception, and that was the coverage of gender. But over the 25-year period, we found that most of the coverage fell within what we called balanced. It was neither far left nor far right. It was really middle of the road. And that, I think, is very different from what you hear and what you see in other discussions of bias.
But you also looked at a couple magazines that have a bit of bias, or at least
yes,
are perceived to. Why did you choose to look at those also?
We also examined National Review and The Progressive, both of which are partisan publications, and their editorial statements denote their partisan viewpoint. We wanted to look at those because one of the things that lacks in the existing research is any comparative, anything to make comparison to. So they say, oh, well, this is left or this is right, compared to what? And so we wanted to look at a set of publications that were left and right-leaning, were liberal and conservative-leaning, and then we would have something to compare it to. And so you can say that, oh, Newsweek is obviously liberal. Liberal compared to what? It's not liberal compared to the Progressive. Not at all. The one exception, as I mentioned, was gender. And I think that that exception exists, and we talk about this in the book, because people do not have a conservative or centrist view about gender in our society. We do not believe that in mass that women shouldn't be allowed to work, that women shouldn't be fighting for equality. And so I think that even if that was slightly skewed, and I mean only slightly liberal in our measurement model, that is reflective of public opinion and not really a sign of bias. And so we need to rethink what is liberal, what is conservative, based on public opinion rather than some arbitrary zero.
Your study covers 1975 to 2000. It's now 2009. Mm-hmm. Do you think your findings are still relevant given all the changes in the media landscape in the past 8 or 9 years?
I think that's hard to say. I don't know that there's that much change. We didn't see a change between prior to 1996 and after 1996 with the Telecommunications Act and the changes that that brought in media ownership during the last few years of the study. So I'm not sure that we would see, especially in these print publications, much of a change between 2000 and 2009.
As you conducted your research, was there anything that surprised you?
One of the things that surprised me most was how little coverage these publications gave to the issue of poverty. Only 19 articles appeared in Time magazine over 25 years about the issue of poverty. 19 articles. And this includes changes in the 1980s to welfare laws and changes in the 1990s with the Welfare Reform Act. So only 19 articles. And in Newsweek, only 31 articles over a 25-year period dealing with the issue of poverty. So I was surprised by that, by how little coverage was given to the issue of poverty. The other thing that surprised me was a shift in the National Review's coverage of crime. Our analysis of crime included coverage of drugs and drug laws, as well as street crime, mandatory sentencing laws, that sort of thing. And what we found was during the period of study, the National Review changed its view on drugs and drug policy. In fact, I think it was in 1996 that they published an article that said the war on drugs is lost. And went from a traditional conservative view, mandatory sentencing, stricter regulation, to a decriminalization stance when it came to drugs and drug laws. And that was really surprising to me. What happened with our study when we were analyzing this is those articles came to be coded as liberal because it took on more of the stances and positions that liberals hold about drug laws. So we found an interesting sort of shift where we had this little blip. All of the articles were conservative, and then articles on drugs, especially after this time period, after this shift, editorial shift, were blipping up, you know, were jumping up to the liberal scale, which was sort of an interesting thing.
Tanya Atkins-Covert teaches sociology at Western Illinois University. She's co-author of the book Media Bias, a comparative study of Time, Newsweek, National Review, and The Progressive, coverage of domestic social issues 1975 to 2000. Atkins-Covert believes those who most strongly argue that bias exists are those with the strongest political views. That includes conservatives and liberals. Atkins-Covert hopes the book convinces readers to move beyond the rhetoric. Rich Egger reporting.
Digital music players are common today. The ability to store an entire music catalog in a device no bigger than the palm of your hand has proven to be popular. But not everyone has jumped on the digital bandwagon. From Macomb, Illinois Public Radio's Joseph Wagner reports.
It's a sound familiar to digital music fans. The click of an iPod scrolling for the right song. But some music fans embrace another sound. A stylist on a vinyl record. The old LP format is making a comeback, and it just might help the music industry. It's hard to say when vinyl began regaining popularity, but ask any vinyl enthusiast, and they'll let you know.
Never really died off as far as an underground level goes.
Virgil Dickerson is the owner of Colorado-based Suburban Home Records, which specializes in punk and folk rock. He also operates Vinyl Collective, which is an online store for, you guessed it, vinyl. Dickerson has been running Vinyl Collective for more than 3 years. Recently, he's seen a growth in sales.
Over the last maybe year, I've just noticed just an explosion. I would say probably the last year and a half, I've seen just a huge growth in vinyl sales.
This explosion in vinyl sales seemed to catch most of the music industry off guard. Music labels are now reissuing their back catalogs on vinyl. Even though vinyl sales rocketed 89% from the year before, they still only account for a bit more than 1% of all music sales. But it's the 89% increase that has labels once again pressing old classics such as Abbey Road and Dark Side of the Moon. One reason music fans are moving to the old LP is the sound quality. Mike Murray is an assistant broadcasting professor at Western Illinois University. He says the MP3 format is just too perfect.
I think the thing that people hear when they hear a good analog setup is a presentation of sound that's easier on the ear. It's a little less compressed.
Digital audio files cover most of the sound spectrum. But to save space on a hard drive or portable device, they're compressed into smaller files, most commonly MP3s. The compression is what gives MP3s their tinny sound.
So what I think people are hearing is something that's a little, it's tailored more to the kinds of frequencies our ears are good at hearing, okay, which is a real sort of warm, smooth representation of the middle frequencies, kind of a natural roll-off of the high end. And then the low frequencies are pretty comparable to CD.
Sound is not the only reason people are going back to the LP. When MP3s are purchased or downloaded from the internet, it almost seems like nothing happened. The buyer has nothing physical to show for their purchase. For WIU music education major Douglas Kuzminoff, vinyl is just the opposite.
I like the idea of a needle picking up the vibrations. And the fact that, you know, a vinyl is so much bigger, it's like art, it is artwork. It's like a poster almost. You can hang it up on your wall.
The art, Kuzminoff adds, is the packaging of the vinyl as well.
And vinyls, you know, they come with, you know, better stuff. They'll come with like a huge lyric sheet. You know, the liner notes will be awesome. And you can get like colored vinyl. It's not just a piece of metal.
Mike Murray believes there's a feeling one gets when buying vinyl that simply is not there with MP3s.
You know, and MP3s are the same way. They're very handy, and you can get an entire catalog onto a little iPod or something like that, and that's great, but there's nothing to handle. You know, there's a certain sort of romance, a certain sort of gratification.
It's that gratification that is drawing people back to vinyl. In addition, most new LPs provide a bonus. They include a little square of paper with a code on it. This code allows the buyer to go online and download the album for free. This way, the buyer not only has the record for home use, but the MP3 version for portable use. Dickerson feels without this free download, most record buyers would illegally download the music anyway.
You know, I don't think it's very fair to ask, especially in this economic climate, a music fan to purchase more than one version of the album. Thank you for
the record. This fairness is going over well with music fans. It's bridging the old technology with the new and giving vinyl the look that it's here to stay. Again, Joseph Wagner reporting.
Pirates hold an enduring fascination. They're the subject of literature, trashy romances, and movies. Now an exhibit at the Field Museum in Chicago seeks to demystify them. It provides historical perspective at a time when pirates are making the news again. Lynette Kalsness reports.
A class of fifth graders from Francis Xavier Ward's school in Chicago is lined up, waiting impatiently. They're eager to see the exhibit, Real Pirates. It includes more than 200 artifacts like treasure and cannons from a sunken pirate ship.
I've been waiting for this for a long time.
That excitement spills over into their best guesses at how pirates talked.
Arg! Ahoy, matey!
I bet they swore a lot.
Yeah, I bet they swore a lot, too.
What else do you know about pirates?
They have peg legs and parrots.
The exhibit examines myths about pirates and takes a look at the golden age of piracy that ended nearly three centuries ago. A few surprises. Some pirates did have peg legs and eye patches. Hey, it was a dangerous job. Some had pets on board, like cats and dogs and, yes, parrots. But they didn't make people walk the plank.
It was kind of a lot of pomp and ceremony for something where they would have probably just thrown them overboard.
Tom Skorsky is a project manager for exhibitions at the Field. He says it's important to look back because history can shed light on what's happening now.
The fact is, they still did kill people. They still did raid ships. And the difference between current pirates in Somalia and what these pirates were doing is not very different. Yet, for some reason, we have this romantic view of them through literature and popular culture.
The Somalis aren't the only ones attacking ships and holding crews and ships for ransom. But an agency that monitors piracy says more than a third of the attacks last year were off the coast of Somalia. Despite these modern-day attacks, pirates still have pop culture status that shows up in fashion like puffy shirts and meetup groups.
They say that the number two Halloween costume for adults is pirates. You know, the Treasure Island pirates, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, they represent kind of this bad boy image of, you know, pirates. They did their own thing. They answered to no one. And so I think that there's something very appealing about that to people.
That romanticized view is why teacher Katie Lucas is here with her fifth graders.
They're already starting to make connections with novels and things we've read about slavery and pirates, and you're hearing them make connections with current events. So we're trying to sort of get the Hollywood out of that and make it more realistic to them.
Her students, Gordon Young and Matt Spector, look around with interest. They make immediate links with current events.
Yeah, it's cool to learn about pirates and exhibits, but if you really think about it, pirates are really bad people.
And how about today? Are there any pirates still today?
Yeah, they go on huge cruise ships and take things for ransom.
They're from a country, Somalia, that had a civil war and their government broke up.
Pirates now don't have, like, those pistols anymore. They are loaded with, like, the newest guns, like machine guns and AK-47s and that kind of stuff.
Another student, Raina Lee, is intrigued to learn that pirates voted on things.
They were kind of like us today. With our president, they voted for their captain, like we vote for our president and stuff.
But the most surprising discovery is a chest full of coins.
Why is it so oddly shaped?
Yeah. I always thought they looked like perfect coins.
Yeah.
The students learned that pirates didn't bury their treasure after all. Olivia Guida says it makes sense that they wore the coins as jewelry. She says she never really got the point of burying the treasure. I'm Lynette Kalsness.
The exhibit Real Pirates continues at the Field Museum in Chicago through October. For more information, visit the website www.fieldmuseum.org.
Earth and Sky.
Most HIV patients today are either in India or Africa, and they don't have the resources to really take blood, send it to a central lab, get the counts back.
You're listening to Aidan Ozjan, head of the Bio and Nanophotonics Laboratory at UCLA. He's developing a device to detect infectious diseases in people in the most impoverished parts of the world using a cell phone.
If you look at the statistics of how cell phones are being used today in the world, it's an amazing story to find out that more than 20% of the population in Africa, in India, in Brazil, they still carry cell phones.
Dr. Ozjan, who's an optics expert, modified a standard cell phone with a camera sensor to diagnose malaria and monitor HIV-infected patients. He added a